I'd like to share with you a section of a book called Telling the Truth, The Gospel as Tragedy, Comedy, and Fairy Tale. So the sermon comes to a close, the hymn comes to a close, with a somewhat unsteady amen, and the organist gestures the choir to sit down. Fresh from breakfast with his wife and children, and a quick run-through of the Sunday papers, the preacher climbs the steps into the pulpit. With his sermon in his hand, he hikes up his black robe at the knee so he won't trip over it on the way up. His mouth is a little dry. He cut himself shaving. He feels as if he swallowed an anchor. If it weren't for the honor of the thing, he would just as soon be somewhere else. In the front pews, the older ladies turn up the hearing aids, and a young lady slips her 6-year-old a lifesaver and a magic marker. A college sophomore home for vacation, who was there because he was dragged there, slumps forward with his chin in his hand. And the vice president of a bank, who twice that week has seriously contemplated suicide, puts his hymnal in the rack. A pregnant girl feels the life stir inside her. A preacher's there, too, in the audience. It's a busman's holiday for him. His church council has urged him to take a week off for a badly needed rest, and he's come to hear how somebody else does it for a change. It isn't that he doesn't love his wife, but just that pushing 60, he has been caught preposterously off guard by someone who lets him open his heart to her, someone willing in her beauty to hear out the old spellbinder, who as a minister never had anybody to minister to him. The preacher pulls a little cord that turns on the lectern light, and he deals out his note cards like a riverboat gambler. The stakes have never been higher. 2 minutes from now, he may totally lose his hearers. But at this moment, he has them right in the palm of his hand. The silence in the shabby church is deafening because everybody's listening to it. Everybody's listening, including himself. Everybody knows the kinds of things that this preacher has told them before. But who knows what he's going to tell them this time? Out of the silence, what will he tell them? Let him tell them the truth. Before the gospel is a word, it is a silence. It's the silence of their own lives and of his life. It is life with the sound turned off so that for a moment or two you can experience it not in terms of the words you make it bearable by, but for the mystery it is. Let him say, "Be silent and know that I am God." And drawing on nothing fancier than the poetry of his own life, let him use words and images that help make the surface of our lives transparent to the truth that lies deep within them, which is the wordless truth of God and who we are and who God is in the gospel of our meeting. Let him tell the truth. You made a series of statements about expectations you have. Obviously, this I cannot promise or do. But what I can do is to talk about forgiveness and with you try and factor out forgiveness. What I can do is to talk about learning to be able to forgive. I'm not sure I can talk about it as being something that's free and easy. Because my theology tells me that when it came to God's forgiveness of man, that was not free and easy. That was painful and passionate. There's a lot of statements up here that talk about learning to forgive. Before I talk to you, I want to share with you some of who I am. It was good for me to be with you this afternoon and see your tremendous ability to have fun and how you got into the fun and the play. I tend to be in my life more serious. I need more play. I need more fun in my life. I also tend to be very introspective and look within myself a lot. And I hope that being who I am and talking to you about the story of my own life will help you, and that you'll help me during this time here to play. I'm 51 years old. I've had 4 kids. My wife is here, Jan. I have a girl who's 24, one who's 22, and they're both in Los Angeles, a boy 21, a junior at PLU, and a boy 17, a senior in high school. I have not been in a parish setting or worked with the young people, high school people, for 13 years. And so I'm here to listen to you too. What's happening with you in your world? What does forgiveness mean to you? What's it all about? What does life mean to you where you are? And I'm here to try and share with you some of what life means to me. And I'm going to do that out of the context of my experiences. And most of the experiences I'll draw from are the prison experiences in Shelton. Shelton is the home of the correction center, not the penitentiary. The penitentiary is in Walla Walla. Because I think my experience at Shelton taught me a lot and forced me to deal with the whole concept of forgiveness. And I think one thing that gets people in trouble in life is their inability to forgive themselves, primarily because we can't really forgive others until we know what it means to be forgiven ourselves. And I've seen more guys come into a prison setting really trying to be cool and having to be cool and so scared of anything to do with the gospel or so scared of anything to do with forgiveness. I remember one guy came in whose name was Gary, and the first time I saw Gary, I said, this guy's got an awful lot to learn. He came into prison about 18 years old, and he was a guy that kind of sat there, you know, like he had it all together. And he was very instrumental in pressuring guys around him. He was fairly well-built, a tough guy, and he ran his game on a lot of people. And Gary got out of prison, and most people, when Gary got out, said, Gary's going to be back, because Gary just hasn't got it together. I left Shelton January 1983, and after that, sure enough, Gary came back. And Gary kept playing his games. And I'm sure you're aware of the fact that there are more drugs in prison than outside of prison. And when you play with drugs and you sell drugs and you get caught or you beat people with drugs, you're in big trouble in prison. Well, Gary was playing his games. And one of my chaplain friends who's still at the prison told me that Gary's dead. He hung himself. Now, I don't know whether he really hung himself or he got hung because of a bad drug deal. But Gary didn't know anything about what forgiveness meant. But he thought he knew a lot of what was it about, to be cool, to be tough, and to put on a facade. I had a friend in prison who was about the same age I am, 51 years old. He spent 31 years of his life in prison, in and out, in and out, in and out. What this guy used to do, he used to be an enforcer. He used to break people's arms and legs who didn't pay their bills out on the streets. He was a hard guy. Roman Catholic background. He came to me one day and he says, Chaplain, I got to talk to a priest. I got to go to confession. And he didn't want to see the state Catholic priest because he got beat one time by a state Catholic priest, so we got him a Catholic priest out of Olympia because Willie had to go to confession. I got to go to confession. The importance of forgiveness. I'm a kind of a sports buff. I played baseball at high school and college and have always been interested in sports, and I subscribe periodically to Sports Illustrated. And I think sometimes Sports Illustrated puts out some really great articles. And I don't know if you read the article or not, but there's an article about a Pitt college linebacker, a sophomore named Todd Becker. Anybody read that article in Sports Illustrated? December 15th, 1982. The Pitt football team had a 9-2 record and was ranked number 6 in the nation. And they were scheduled to leave for the Cotton Bowl the next day. Todd Becker was a sophomore backup linebacker for the Panthers, a special teams demon who says Coach Fazio just leveled his man. Well, Todd Becker was out to a party at Pitt sorority, and he was supposed to stay away from those parties for disciplinary reasons. Somebody turned on a fire alarm system. The campus security came, and Todd says, I got to get out of here. I'm going to be kicked off the team. He went into a room that was about 35 feet off the ground, and Todd went out that window, hung on the ledge, and figured he could jump down that 35 feet and be all right and everything would be good. Well, he got out on that ledge, and one of the guys in the room said, hey, Todd, don't do that. That's too far down there. And he grabbed a hold of his arm, but Todd says, hey, man, I can make it. And he shoved himself off away from the ledge, and on the way down, he hit an air conditioner, spun him around, landed on his head, and was killed. The coach went down to the emergency entrance, and there was Todd, and he said he was lying there, and he just looked alive. He had one of his old game jerseys on. He had those big arms, and he looked so alive. Well, the reaction to that young man's death was very interesting. Todd was a good kid. He was a rough kid, a good linebacker. But you know, Todd had a tattoo on his leg. And the tattoo Todd had was a grinning Sylvester the Cat with Tweety Bird by the neck with a piece of rope. Well, it's kind of funny, but it's also kind of violent. And that's the way Todd lived. And I've seen a lot of tattoos on people in prison, whether it's Born to Raise Hell or whatever it is they got on. And there was a closing statement in this article on Todd Becker that I thought was really great. Coach Fazio had a picture of the Pitt team in 1963 that had a 9-1 record. But he didn't play on that squad and he didn't coach it. But the picture was in his room because of what the players on that squad accomplished. Of the 61 players on that roster, 57 graduated and 34 got advanced degrees to become doctors, engineers, dentists, lawyers, coaches, teachers, businessmen. And then the last statement about Todd Becker is this. He says, the imagination of a boy is healthy, and the imagination of a man is healthy. But there's a space of life in between when the soul is in ferment and the character is undecided and the way of life is uncertain and ambition is thick-sighted. It's a pity that Todd Becker didn't make it past the ferment of the soul to adulthood. Well, if I were to state why I'm here, it would be I'd like to do some sharing with you about forgiveness. Because I think knowing and experiencing and living and practicing forgiveness is one way to make it from the ferment of the soul to adulthood. And I would guess that everybody here goes through that. I did, and I know a few people who didn't. So maybe this weekend we can do some reflecting and some talking and some biblical study about how people make it from the ferment of the soul to adulthood. And the coach said, one fellow who talked about, you know, this thing that happened to Todd Becker is something that happens to a lot of kids in college. It's kind of crazy, crazy accidents. And this one fellow said one thing that he found out as he counseled other college students about their student friends that had a tragic accident like this, that just about without exception, they just didn't see themselves as vulnerable They just didn't see themselves as vulnerable. You know, death is for somebody who's older, my grandmother, my grandfather, but hey, there's a sense that as a youth I'm kind of omnipotent and I don't want to be vulnerable. But our theology talks about a vulnerability and about a need for forgiveness and what forgiveness is all about. You know, we all go through personal growth and personal development. We all start out as little babies, and when we're little babies, we kind of respond to life in what is called an organismic way. A little baby tends just to respond out of what's inside the little baby. For example, if the baby hurts, what's the baby do? Cries. Yeah, the baby doesn't say, boy, it's not cool to cry, does it? I'm not going to cry. Baby just cries. If the baby's got a messy pants, what's the baby do? Cries, right? Hey, somebody come and change me. This is uncomfortable, right? And that's kind of a response where a person, there's an integration between what they are inside and what they express on the outside. That's real healthy. But pretty soon a baby begins to get a message. And what's that message? They begin to get a lot of shoulds and a lot of oughts. You ever get that? Like, you know, maybe the baby's in church and the other kid's in church and the mother's sitting there and the father's sitting there and the little baby sitting on the pew like this, and brother or sister's walking around the pew and steps on the baby's finger and, ah! Right like that. Don't do that. Or carry the baby out. So we get a lot of messages. I think if you would think back, you could think back to a lot of shoulds in your life, can't you? Huh? Think of any shoulds? What kind of shoulds you had as a kid? Anybody? Huh? What? What's some shoulds you had as a kid? Things that you shouldn't do. Eat all dinner. Clean your plate. All right. Huh? Obey your parents. Okay, absolutely. What's some other shoulds? Huh? Don't play with your food. All right. Get a lot of shoulds. And pretty soon, we get a pretty good idealized self-image or a blueprint of who we're supposed to be from our parents. And after our parents get through, then where do we start getting our shoulds and our blueprints? Huh? Teachers? Okay. Peers. What kind of message do you get from your peers? I'm cool. And what is to be cool? Huh? You know, I had a guy in the prison, he's a black guy, and he was in for armed robbery, and this is a really tough guy. His father died while he was in prison, and the chaplain I had as a student went down to see him, and he went down, and he said, I've got bad news for you, your dad's dead. And the black fellow sat there, and he began to cry. He began to cry, and he says, listen, chaplain, he says, I'm crying with you right now. But tomorrow out in the yard, I'll be the tough nigger. And nobody will know I cried. Not cool, man, to cry. I had a guy in prison who was kind of one of the enforcers around there. And he would come in and talk to me, and he'd break down and cry in my office. He said, God, I wish I didn't have to play the tough guy out there all the time. And one time I had that guy stand up in the chapel service and talk about vulnerability. And he almost couldn't do it because he had to be the tough guy. I had an interesting thing happen in the prison. We had a bunch of people come in from the streets to put on a group dynamic thing in the prison. We had one guy there named Rocky. And Rocky was a tough guy. Rocky walked like this, you know, with kind of one shoulder up with a chip on it. And this guy said to the group there, he said, look, he says, I know all you guys what you're all about. I know you guys. I know exactly what every guy in here is all about. He said, if you don't believe me, anybody that wants to, stand up and I'll tell you exactly who you are. We had three guys stand up. And Rocky was one of them. And he stood up like this and looked at the guy like that. He says, Rocky, he says, you really have to be a tough guy, don't you? Just your name, Rocky, and the way you walk around. But I got news for you, Rocky. Inside, you are probably the most sensitive guy in this room, but you're scared to death of it. Rocky didn't say a word. He just sat right down because he was right on. Your peers tell you who you have to be. And you build, a lot of times, you build this facade. If that's who they expect me to be, that's who I better be. And one of the worst things in the world is not to fit in. Not to fit in. But at a certain point in life, we begin to understand that that facade doesn't work. And we begin to say, who I really want to be is who I am in here. And I don't care what anybody says. And we get back to being real. And one way that you have the freedom to be on the outside who you really are on the inside is through forgiveness. The forgiveness of Christ. Because forgiveness sets you free. You know, one time there was a chaplain coming across after the end of World War II on a troop transport. And some of the sailors on that transport and the soldiers got together and said, say, chaplain, would you give us a Bible study? And he said, okay. He was kind of surprised that people wanted a Bible study, so he gave him a Bible study. And he studied the 11th chapter of John. I want you to turn to the 11th chapter of John. Okay, would somebody read verse 1 and 3 and 17? Somebody read those three verses, 1, 3, and 17. Let me have a hand. Somebody read that. Would you? Thank you. And somebody read verses 32 through 35. Who will read that? 32 to 35. Thank you. And somebody read 38 to 41. Somebody read that? 38 to 41? You read that? Okay. And somebody read 43 and 44. This was his study. 43 and 44. Who will read that? You will find. All right. Somebody read verses 1, 3, and 17.
Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is sick.
Okay, now verse 17.
On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem. And many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them while lost their birth.
Okay, he was dead for 4 days, right? And they didn't have the morticians and the embalmers that we have today, but he was in the grave for 4 days when Jesus got there. Now verses 32 to 35. Okay, and then verses 38 to 41. Okay, 43 through 44.
After he had said this, he called out loud, Lazarus, come out. He came out, his hands and his feet wrapped in grave clothes, and they cloth around his face. Untie him, Jesus told him, and let him go.
All right, now suppose you'd been there at that time. Get the picture. A brother is sick of Mary and Martha. They get word to Jesus to come and heal their brother. Jesus comes 4 days late when he's been dead for 4 days and he's in the tomb and his body's begun to decay. Jesus goes to the tomb, says, roll away the stone there, open the grave, and he says, Lazarus, come forth, and he comes forth. Now, suppose you'd been there. What would you have been your reaction to that? Would it have been disbelief? This is some kind of a trick or a fraud? Would it have been ecstasy? My goodness, here's a miracle beyond all miracles. Would it have been awe? Who in the world is this Christ? Who is this Jesus? Would it have been excitement? Something tremendous has happened? Would it have been hope? Hey, something like this can happen to me. Would it have been fear? Death and grave clothes? How would you have reacted to that? How many would have felt the disbelief, it's a fraud? Huh? Raise your hand. Let's see. Okay. All right. How about ecstasy? It's a miracle. Huh? Okay. How about awe? Who is this Jesus? And how would you feel about me if I'm come here as your speaker and you want me to give you some... Hey, you don't want to get... What was this here? Never get bored in a program that doesn't get dull. Well, tonight I'm really going to send you people out of here charged up because I'm coming in here with a casket. And in this casket, I'm putting a dead body. And before this meeting's over, I'm going to raise this dead body right out of this casket. And what would you think of it? Huh? I do it in the name of God. What would you think of it? Huh? What about that? Would anybody leave here and not go? I'm crazy, but the guy's walking around. Huh? Yeah.
I think she's sick, man. The cave body walking around.
Anybody leave here not being a Christian? Huh? Would anybody leave here not being a Christian if I pulled that off?
No.
What do you think? Huh? What? 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 Huh? All right, well, how about the faith? Would you have any faith in the one that in whose name I did? Huh? What? You know, one time there was a fellow that there's a story told in the Bible about a rich man and Lazarus. And Lazarus died, and the rich man died, and the rich man went to hell or Hades, and Lazarus went to heaven, to Abraham's bosom. And the rich man said to Abraham, remember what he said? I got five brothers back there on the earth. And he says, send Lazarus back from the dead, and my five brothers will believe. Remember that story? Remember what Abraham said? He says, they've got Moses and the prophets. He says, they got the scriptures. If they won't believe the scriptures, they won't believe that somebody come back from the dead. Because if your faith in God is only based on, quote, miracles, those kind of people always want one more miracle. One more miracle. When Jesus hung on the cross, they said, you come down from the cross and you'll what? Will believe. One more miracle. No, your faith in God, friends, is faith. It's faith. But after the chaplain had that Bible study, those soldiers and sailors left, and some of them laughed, and some of them weren't too interested. He thought it went kind of like a typical Bible study. But one guy came to the chaplain and he said, chaplain, I want you to know that what happened in the 11th chapter of John happened in my lifetime. That I feel like a new person. Some things happened to me in the war that I just couldn't get any peace about. But when I heard that story of Lazarus and new life, I've got new life and I want to thank you. It's been a resurrection. Well, I believe that the forgiveness factor is a resurrection factor. And I believe that God takes dead people and makes them live. The scriptures talk about being dead in trespasses and sins and made alive unto God. There's a story told about a bunch of people went to the theater. And when they were at the theater, an actor came out on stage and he said, I'd like to have you people leave very quietly and in order because the theater's on fire. Nobody smelled any smoke. Nobody saw the fire. There was a small fire starting upstairs in the
balcony attic of the church, of the theater, and the audience didn't quite know what to do. And all of a sudden, somebody coughed and said, "Hey, that guy is a great actor. You'd think the place was on fire, wouldn't you?" And the more impassioned that actor got to tell these people to get out of that building because there was a fire, the louder they coughed. They thought he was just acting. And the building burned down. And not everybody got out. So I want to tell you very clearly, this weekend that I'm with you, I'm not acting. Forgiveness is critical. The forgiveness factor is a critical factor in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And one of the toughest places to experience that forgiveness is for the individual to experience, to believe that you are forgiven. Sometimes it's easy to believe that God forgives me, or my friend forgives me, but it's hard for me to understand that I forgive myself. I had a situation with a good friend of mine who I worked with in prison. He got out of prison and came back as a chaplain's assistant. And he was in prison for killing his wife. And he came back as a chaplain's assistant, and he just could not see himself as a staff member of that prison because he saw himself still as an inmate, even though he'd done his time. And we had a communion service for him, where the confession of the communion service was his sharing what happened in the time he killed his wife. And we gave him the sacrament as an act of absolution and forgiveness. And there were tears in his eyes as he received that forgiveness. And just about a week ago, I was with that man, who's now 67, 68 years old, when he was commissioned as a lay staff person in the American Lutheran Church. And his son, who was just ordained a pastor, preached a sermon at his commissioning service. And the boy came down and hugged his dad. The boy forgave his dad too. He was a beautiful, beautiful friend. Now what I'd like to have you do for a little while is do a study on the life of a biblical character, and that character is Peter. Use your Bible if you want to, but I'd like to have you tell me something about the feel about the life of Simon Peter. Read your Bible, it's in Mark, the Gospel of Mark, if you want to look up some verses. Luke, the 5th chapter, the 8th verse. The Gospel of Mark, chapter 8, verses 29 through 33. Let me just have somebody pick some of those verses. Somebody take the 5th chapter of Luke. Read those first 11 verses in Luke 5. Somebody do that?
Chapter 5, verses 1 to 11. Somebody read that? Thank you.
Somebody take Mark chapter 8, verses 29 through 33. Can you do that? Thank you. And then somebody take... Luke 22, verse 61. And somebody take Mark chapter 14, verses 33 through 34. And somebody take Mark 16, verse 7. Mark 16, verse 7. Who will take that?
You're a fan, all right, thank you. Would you take... 1 Peter
3:15,
please.
Okay, let's go through that. Luke chapter 5, verses 1 to 11. Keep
that. You know that?
Right? He was the leader of the disciples. When Jesus told him that he was going to be praying, remember what Peter said to him? Huh? No! Hey, all the other guys were going to be praying, and you can count on me, Simon Peter, right? You betcha. And then he denies him. And one of the most graphic pictures in the scripture is after the denial when Jesus is going to his death, and Peter and Jesus' eyes meet. And it's at that point that Peter goes out and leaves the city. He was a guy who was really inconsistent. One minute he's saying you're the Christ, the Son of God, and the next minute Jesus is saying to him, get behind me, so you understand the things you got. Who's got Mark 16:7? Who's got that? One of my favorite passages in the Bible. You go tell the disciples, this is after the resurrection. Jesus hadn't seen Peter since when? Since the time he read, when he looked at him and he wept bitterly. He hadn't seen him since then. And it's the post-resurrection appearance, and what is Peter told, or these ladies are told, go tell the disciples of who? Peter. Be sure and tell Peter that he's risen. If I was Simon Peter and I had denied him, and I was hanging around there and wondering, you know, not probably thinking I'd ever face this Jesus again, then you hear the resurrection, the woman comes back with a message, and as part of that message was, that hey, Peter, special word for you, that he's risen. The word of forgiveness. And then what does Peter write in 1 Peter 3:15? You got that? What is he saying? Always be ready to give an answer to anybody that asks you a reason for the hope or the faith that's inside of you. Because Peter was saying, in his memory, I wasn't. I was asked 3 times by some girls around the fire if I was his disciple, and 3 times I said no. And so he writes to his people and he says, be always ready to give an answer. You talk about your organization, A-L-Y, is it? I think a good goal for everybody in ALY is to always be ready to give an answer to anybody that asks you a reason of the hope that's inside of you. Right? Because ALY is not just some close organization where a lot of kids are supposed to get together. ALY is an organization that believes in the forgiveness factor. And if it doesn't, then why play me? The forgiveness factor.
Well, I'd like to close with a couple of quotes from one of my heroes. And that man is a guy that was killed in 1968, and his name is Martin Luther King. And his wife wrote a book on his sayings. And I leave these thoughts with you. We must develop, he said, and maintain the capacity to forgive. He who is devoid of the power to forgive is devoid of the power to love. There is some good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us. When we discover this, we are less prone to hate our enemies. Forgiveness is not an occasional act. It is a permanent attitude. And here's a statement that Dr. King said that I recall from a long time ago. A person who won't die for something is not fit to live for anything. We believe in the forgiveness factor. And the forgiveness of God is exciting, and it sets you totally free to be who you are and gives you the freedom to be on the outside who you are on the inside. Because whoever and whatever you are forgiven. no strings attached. God bless you, forgiven, free people of God. Amen.